It's wonderful as always to return. It's always coming home for me. Tonight I feel a little bit naughty because it's a nasty little book I'm going to talk about. When I was here almost exactly a year ago to talk about Love's Labour's Lost by Shakespeare, I apologized because I was going to be discussing a comedy during the season of Lent. And I made something like an excuse. But curiously tonight, when you think it might be even more appropriate for me to apologize for talking about this work during the season of Lent, I will not do so. And the reason for that is, even though the manner of the book is unusual, the matter of the book is Lenten. In a letter to a friend, Waugh wrote about the reasons why he wrote this short novel, The Loved One. I'll talk about those reasons, but his fifth and final reason is simply the little Latin phrase, memento mori, a reminder of death. And what could be more appropriate for the Lenten season than to focus our thoughts on death? Because thoughts of death are indeed where our mind should be placed, and because of the fact of death, the need to do penance, the need to take life seriously, but perhaps even more so, given the unfortunate conditions of the modern world in which we find ourselves, we have to know what death is before we can focus on it. And one reason the book was written was not just to be a reminder of death, but try to remind us what death actually is to a human being, and on a larger scale, what it means in God's divine plan. That means we have, with this small, nasty comic novel, a very serious core. As with any good joke, there's something solid and truthful at the heart of it. Now, you might ask yourself, especially since Evelyn Waugh was noted for being a Catholic writer, where's the Catholicism here? And I want to start out by just talking a little bit about the manner of the book, because it is so unusual. Tomorrow night I'm going to speak at greater length about Waugh's career, tell you something about the man, the shape of his career, who he was, and make a kind of defense of him as being that rare thing in the 20th century, an artist who was an absolute genius and master. There aren't many of them. We do have a few, and I believe that Mr. Waugh is indeed one of them. But in terms of this particular book of, as I would make the claim, such serious substance, how very odd that this Catholic writer doesn't mention Catholicism other than in passing on a couple of occasions. Well, it has to do with the unfortunate stance that a modern writer has to take in writing for a modern audience. And the fact of the matter is, Waugh, while he was a comic writer, and while he believed firmly in the Catholic faith, only on occasion would write directly about that faith. He was aware, on one hand, there is no surer way to make people stop listening to what you have to say than to state it openly. That number two, there was so much nonsense in the air that people, even being given a hint of the topic of religion, would immediately close their ears and stop listening. So that one of the problems of the Catholic writer is, how do you deal with Catholic ideas seriously and still have a readership? And it's very difficult because those who don't believe don't want to listen, and those who do believe just want something nice and pretty that won't ruffle their feathers at all. And between the two, it's very difficult to write seriously. Let me give you an example of this. The stance that Waugh takes in this novel, I'm going to claim, is ironic. This is an example of a literary device that's difficult to define, which is called irony. Now, irony is sort of a cousin to another literary stance, another literary form called satire. in which the author makes fun of or exaggerates or mocks the world in which he finds himself in order to present a truth. Waugh always claimed he was not a satiric writer, that it was impossible to write satire in the modern world, because in order to write satire, you had to have an audience all of whom agreed on a common point of view and a common vision. In the modern world, there's absolutely no agreement about how the world should be run, how we should live, and what we should believe, and therefore, there is no solid ground to call an audience back to. You cannot exaggerate, you cannot make fun, because no two, three, four people are going to have the same idea in their head, and therefore, what are you calling them to? They won't understand your satire, they won't understand what you're doing, they won't agree with you. Therefore, he claimed, I can't be satiric. The age of satire is gone. But he could be ironic. What does that mean? It means talking about something at a distance, at a remove, not saying directly what you intend to say, and as a result, making the reader do the initial work. Here's my example from another great 20th century modern work, one of the greatest. That is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago. That massive, three-volume, 2,000-page history of the slave labor camps in the Soviet Union. The first chapter of the first volume of Gulag that refers to the massive system by which Russian citizens were arrested and sent to the camps is called The History of Our Sewage Disposal System. It is dreadfully ironic. Solzhenitsyn is writing about a very serious subject, but found himself incapable of simply saying the history of how the police arrested people and sent them to the camps. It was mundane, it was flat, and somehow could not capture the immense barbarity, the incredible, inhuman conditions with which these people were treated. So he uses that chapter title suggesting the Soviet state viewed its own citizens as sewage, and as a result, simply flushed them away with as much care and compassion and understanding as one flushes a commode. Does this mean that Solzhenitsyn was hard-hearted, did not care? No. He was simply aware that that what he was about to describe was so outrageous, was so outlandish. What the Soviet KGB and the police had done was so inhuman, he couldn't just state it in ordinary terms. And therefore, he had to come up with some way of making the reader do part of the work. You open the book and you think, what's he going to talk about plumbing for? Why is he going to talk about this at the beginning of the book? And you begin reading and you realize, this is ghastly. This is awful. This is not necessarily comic. This is painful. That is what Waugh does in most of his great comic novels. He will not directly tell us what he's thinking, but as we read the book, it becomes clearer and clearer what he's thinking. But through this dark comedy, through this seemingly exaggerated presentation of what's going on, we have to fill in the truth. And the truth becomes more and more evident as this picture he's drawing becomes more and more exaggerated, more and more outlandish, until finally you can't miss his point, even though he doesn't have to say it directly. Now let me give an example of how this is working right from the start of this novel, which has the funniest little preamble of any book ever written. Most books don't come with a warning. And before we even get to the book proper, he's giving us a warning. It is indeed true. He wrote this immediately upon a returning from a visit to Hollywood. In the late 40s, he had been invited to Hollywood because they were going to film his novel, Brideshead Revisited, which had been a huge success. And the Hollywood studios wanted to buy the script, make a film of it. It would be hugely popular. So they invited Mr. and Mrs. Waugh to Hollywood. He took advantage of it. They came from England. They took a train across the country. They spent some wonderful days in Hollywood, And while he was there, negotiations broke down because the studio insisted that he change the ending. He had to give them permission to change the ending and make it a happy ending. Those of you who know the novel, in the Hollywood version, of course, Charles and Julia would get together and live happily ever after. Waugh absolutely refused. No contract, no deal, no money, it fell through, but he'd had a nice trip to California, which he hadn't seen before, but while he was there, someone took him to see Forest Lawn Cemetery. And as he said, he was fascinated and repelled. He was mesmerized by the place. He couldn't believe such a place could exist on Earth. He was haunted by it, and the germ of the idea began. So that the book is based absolutely on a real place, real facts, almost everything that's in the book, some exaggerations, but that's Forest Lawn. That was the big cemetery just outside of Hollywood. So in order to underline the point, he gives us this little warning. This is a purely fanciful tale. A little nightmare produced by the unaccustomed high living of a brief visit to Hollywood. Readers whose pleasure in fiction derives from identifying the characters and scenes with real people and real places will be disappointed. If in the vast variety of life in America there is anyone at all like any of the characters I have invented, I can only remind that person that we never met and assure him or her that, had we done so, I would not have attempted to portray a living individual in a book where all the incidents are entirely imaginary. That's gut-busting funny. What he's saying, this is all real. I met you people, and you're all in here, described accurately. And how does he get us to know that? Because he insists on the opposite and insists on it in such an extreme, overstated manner, we get the ironic joke. What does he mean? The opposite of what he's saying. As I have said, this is a nightmare, and in parts, perhaps, somewhat gruesome. The squeamish should return their copies to the library or the bookstore unread. It's the only case I know of anywhere in literature where the author says at the beginning of the book, you probably don't want to read this book. What is he saying? Turn the page. Turn the page. You're not going to take this back to the library. You're not going to take this back. Because I just said, ooh, there's really awful stuff in here, knowing full well, oh, yeah, I got to read it. Got to read it. What have we got? More irony. He is, again, meaning the opposite of what he seems to be saying. And it's very clear that the warning at the beginning says, this is a true story. Read this book. Okay? This is how the entire work is going to proceed. The entire work is going to proceed this way. We are being given one thing, but it's very clear the author means something else. Now, let me give you the list of things that Waugh said the novel was about. Some of them I'm going to deal with specifically. Others I'll have to deal with glancingly. And there's more than just this. This is just a quick list that he jotted down to a friend. The ideas I had in mind were, number one, quite predominantly, overexcitement with the scene. He had visited Forest Lawn. It stimulated his mind to such a degree, he had to write about it. Okay? But I love it. Overexcitement with the scene. The artist got overstimulated by something he had witnessed. He had to turn it into art. Number two, the Anglo-American impasse. Never the twain shall meet. That there is a huge gulf between the British and the Americans, and they will never understand each other. That's for others to comment on. Three, there is no such thing as an American. They are all exiles, uprooted, transplanted, and doomed to sterility. The ancestral gods they have abjured get them in the end. There's a true story. While he was taking the train across from Chicago to Hollywood, he was sitting in the dining car with his wife and asked for some particularly British drink. And the waiter had no idea what he was talking about, and there was a total collapse in communication. And finally, Waugh, attempting to explain why they didn't understand each other, said to the waiter, I am a foreigner. And the waiter said, sir, we are all foreigners here. This is America. Which indeed underlined that particular point. Number four, the European raiders who come for the spoils and whether or not they are lucky enough to make it home with them. It's the sense of America as a land of opportunity, a gold mine, and the people who come from all over the world to grab the goods, some of whom are lucky enough to get away. Now, not all do, clearly, in the novel. Sir Francis Hinsley doesn't. He is destroyed. Dennis, that rascal, gets away with it, okay? Well, we'll talk more about our very naughty hero in a little bit, okay? He is in a line of war heroes. They're not quite anti-heroes, but they're awfully close to it. They are scamps. They are rogues. They are very nasty people. But one reason is they've caught on to the modern world, and they're going to use it to their advantage, okay? And they will manipulate and use anything in order to get ahead. Dennis is in that particular line, and that's what he does. And number five, as I mentioned, memento mori, a reminder of death. The book makes us think about death, and it does so curiously by making very clear that in America, Americans were trying to transform death into something other than what it is. Okay? The complete transformation of this fact, this unpleasant but very real fact, into something quite other. We'll talk about that. Let's start the discussion where the book itself was sparked, where Waugh's imagination was sparked. And that is with Forest Lawn, which is transformed in the novel into Whispering Glades. The name of the memorial park itself, we'll call it, gives a lovely pastoral vision and is itself something quite other than deathly. Forest lawn, whispering glades, a place of nature, green grass, pleasant zephyrs blowing about, okay? And the vision is a worldly vision of a happy pastoral scene. Now, Waugh was aware that into that pastoral world can intrude death. Death can be a part of it, and death is an intrusion. And just as when death eventually made its way into paradise, at any moment, that pastoral scene can be violated. Part one of Brideshead Revisited, for those of you who know it, is called Et in Arcadia Ego, which is the title of a painting by Nicolas Poussin that is set in a pastoral scene, and three shepherds have come upon a tomb. And in the midst of this beautiful pastoral scene, they are staring uncomprehendingly at this tomb. Death has entered the world of beauty and nature, and they don't yet comprehend it. That is a fact. That is, again, a reality. At any moment, death can enter into the beauties of life, because it is a fact of life. It is, in one sense, the end of life. What the Memorial Park is trying to do is ensure that death never intrudes by making death itself something to be annihilated. The Memorial Park is seeking to end death as such. Now, Waugh decides that he's going to give this vision of Forest Lawn, which becomes Whispering Glades, but he is an artist. And part of what I want to stress tonight is the extraordinary artistry of this book. So while the central location, the central scene of the novel, is Whispering Glades, there are two other locations that set off this cemetery, this memorial park. And one is Hollywood itself. Forest Lawn was the Hollywood cemetery. But what Waugh does is use Hollywood as a kind of contrast or one way of understanding what's wrong with Whispering Glades, the lie of Whispering Glades. And on the other side, He creates the pet cemetery, the happier hunting ground, okay? That is also a cemetery, but a kind of phony imitation of Whispering Glades. And we begin to understand the lies and indeed the real disastrous nature of the phony place of death, Whispering Glades, by examining these other two worlds, okay? So we have the central world, Whispering Glades, but the novel very, very beautifully sets up these two contrasts. And by looking at the two contrasts, we come to learn things about the main feature, the Memorial Park, Whispering Glades. Now, let me start with Hollywood, because that's where we begin. That's where we begin. And if Hollywood is about anything, it's about phoniness, that which is unreal, that which is insubstantial, that which may pretend to seem like the real world, but in fact has nothing whatsoever to do with the real world. For one thing, film itself is phony. We go to the movie theater, we sit there, and we think that we are watching real people moving about. Movies imitate theater. And there are many people who think that when you go to the movies, it's the same thing as going to theater. But of course it's not, because when you go to the theater, there are real actors up there in real time who are acting out an action. And when you go to the movie house, what you are seeing is shadows and light projected on a screen. Those people aren't there. Those people have been captured for an instant on film and are being projected up there. But the thing itself is not real, even though it looks real. I haven't seen the hit movie out there now about the sinking of that big boat. I can't bear to go. The movie takes longer than the actual sinking of the boat took. But everyone's going and all excited about it, and some people are going back over and over again. But the fact of the matter is, it's not the sinking of the boat. And much of it was done in little tanks. And much of it was done with special effects, and none of it's real. The sinking of the boat was real. It's something one wouldn't want to witness. The movie pretends to be real, but the fact is there's nothing real there. And even less than the reality, even less than the phoniness of the construct, is film itself, which is just light and shadow on a screen. There's a wonderful moment. Dennis first goes to Whispering Glades, and the receptionist is showing him around, and he says, well, Sir Ambrose Abercrombie will be... She says, oh, was your loved one in the film business? And Dennis says, yes. And she says, well, then you'll want him to be buried in Shadowlands. Which is a wonderful joke. But the little area of the park where the film people are buried is called Shadowland. Whoa, it's wonderful. A typical brilliant wall moment. And please notice what happens. The book is so brilliantly written and so easy to read, we fly by things quickly. It's such a quick read. It is so clear. We fly by things. Shadowlands, the fact that, oh, he was in film, then he did nothing based on any reality. But inadvertently, this is one of those moments, the woman doesn't know what she's saying, but Waugh does. And what is the echo in our minds if we still have any glimpse at all of what death is? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, and suddenly there's a real shadow land that Sir Francis is going through. Quite different from the phony shadow land at Whispering Glades, and quite real, as opposed to the phoniness of filmdom. Okay? Hollywood, phoniness. That which is fake. That which is not real. And early on, this gets emphasized for us. Okay? Dennis arrives for the first time at Whispering Glades, and as he's going through, he has a sense of what the place is really like, and it reminds him in some ways of Hollywood. Okay, he remembers when he first arrived at the studios. I'm on page 40. Halfway down the page. When as a newcomer to the Megalopolitan Studios, he first toured the lots, it had taxed his imagination to realize that these solid-seeming streets and squares of every period and climate were in fact plaster facades whose backs revealed the structure of billboardings. Okay? The vision of Hollywood is that which appears to be substantial, but is only a phony front. There is nothing solid behind it. There is nothing real behind it. And we get in that a vision for the entire world of Hollywood and California, and yes, he wasn't being nice to those who were his hosts, America, this land he had come to visit. It is a place of falsehood. It is a place where very little is real. And having introduced that idea, and having sent his hero to Hollywood, and having given us that image of it looks real, but there's nothing real there, I just want to now go through a list of things in the book in which we get a phony, false front with nothing behind it. Let's start with this, page 41, very next page. Long paragraph, followed by music, he stepped, as it were, from garden to garden, for the approach to the offices lay through a florist's shop. Here, one young lady was spraying scent over a stall of lilac. That's just wonderful. We have phony flowers, but because they look so real, the people in seeing the flowers want them to smell real, so we take phony perfume and spray it all over the flowers so they will smell like lilacs. Are they flowers? No. Are they lilacs? No. Do they have any smell? No. Do we smell them? Yes. What are we smelling? Something phony. A disconnect between nature and a phony attempt to imitate nature. Why can't we have real lilacs? Because real lilacs wilt and die. Lilacs are products of nature. And the end of nature is growth, decay, and death. And we want the lilacs to remain always in bloom, and therefore we will make these things that look like lilacs and then spray lilac scent on it so it will smell like lilacs. Was artistry. We'll look at this scene later, but remember when Amy Thanatogenes is going out for her big night with Mr. Joyboy and is spraying jungle venom perfume all over herself. Okay? It is an uproarious scene, and we'll look at, but again, please notice what we're doing once again. She is like a lilac. She will not allow the actual body odors that are on her body to be smelled, but she has been told that a young woman on the make after her man sprays on jungle venom. So she sprays it on. We'll look at that scene a little later. It's a brilliant moment. But it's one of those moments. Nothing in this novel is accidental. Waugh is connecting those moments. Okay? Here's another one. And this is similar. I just love this. We go off. Dennis has gone to try to write the memorial poem for Sir Francis. And he's at Whispering Glades, and this boatman, and we have a little vision from classical mythology of Charon the boatman taking the souls across to the little island. It's a vision of Hades from classical mythology, but you have to know classical mythology in order to get the little joke here. But the boatman is taking Dennis across to the Lake Isle of Innisfree, which is named for the great poem by William Butler Yeats, which is, again, a vision of going back to nature, living at nature, being at one with nature, and enjoying the rhythms of nature. But of course, we get to the Lake Isle of Innisfree, top of page 82. I wouldn't know, kid, I never wrote a poem, but they certainly got it fixed up poetic. It's named after a very fancy poem. They got beehives. Once they had bees, too, but folks was always getting stung. So now it's done mechanical and scientific. No sore fannies and plenty of poetry. There's the wonderful line in the poem about the beehives. So if we're going to build a Lake Isle of Industry, we have to beehive. They put real beehives there, and what happened? You had real bees, and bees sting. Nature, it's bad. There's always that darn downside to nature, okay? Therefore, we get rid of the bees, we get rid of the beehives, and now we pipe in the mechanical sound of buzzing bees. No bees, no sore fannies, and plenty of poetry. It is anti-nature. It is at the core of the aisle, of course, it is anti-nature. How about this one? We come upon what will soon be the resting place of Mr. Kaiser. Mr. Kaiser, who has made his millions selling Kaiser's stoneless peaches. Okay? We get at one point later in the book the actual advertisement from the radio for these. This rendition comes to you, by the way, they're sponsoring Wagner. Teutonic passion is pouring out of the radio. And then the announcer comes on and says, this rendition comes to you by courtesy of Kaiser's stoneless peaches. Remember, no other peach now marketed is perfect and completely stoneless. When you buy a Kaiser's stoneless peach, you are buying full weight of succulent peach flesh and nothing else. Dennis has tried this peach, and he says he had once tried to eat one of Mr. Kaiser's much advertised products and had discovered a ball of damp, sweet cotton wool. Poor Frank Hinsley, it was very like him. A real man has become a phony. The pit was taken out of him. Now the pit is that which can crack our tooth when we bite into a peach. But the pit is that which preserves the cycle of nature within the peach. The peach grows, ripens, is plucked from the tree, eaten. The pit is discarded back into the earth from which new peaches grow. Mr. Kaiser hates nature. And heaven help us, all the way through here, the vision of America is a country that despises the natural cycle. And therefore, the natural cycle must be disrupted and corrected. Because nature is wrong, and we're going to get it right. Therefore, we buy a peach, we don't want to bite into it and have that pit there that might break our tooth. And it's also taking away from the weight of the peach, which should be all fruit. And what do we get? We get a phony, concocted, scientifically created peach that may look like a peach. It certainly won't smell like a peach, and it has no taste at all. It has no taste at all. Why? It's no longer a peach. It is the phony appearance of a peach without anything genuinely, without the essence, if you will, of peach being in it any longer. We've got a pattern running through this whole book. It shows up everywhere. Everything is false, phony, like Hollywood itself, tasteless. One other quick one, I love this. Dennis is out with Amy. It's a glorious moment. They go to eat nut burgers. And he's sitting eating with her and says, you know, this is the first time I've ever eaten a nut burger. I've often wondered what they were. Bottom page 137. It is not so much their nastiness as their total absence of taste that shocks one. It's not just that these things are nasty. These things have no taste at all. By the way, this was written before the age of fast food, although you see it coming. And obviously the whole notion of the nut burger is it's some sort of California health thing where it's probably, you know, now we get soy burgers and things like this because they won't eat the real meat anymore. You can't have a real health because it's bad for you. You know, you eat that and then the cholesterol gets in your veins, then you have a heart attack and die. Therefore, you eat a soy burger and you don't get the cholesterol and you will live forever. It is again an attempt to overcome nature. It is again an attempt to supersede God's plan. And we'll do it better and we'll get it right, okay? Even if it means eliminating taste, eliminating definition, eliminating the solidity of buildings in Hollywood, phony fronts, the real bees that buzz and make, but also sting, the lilacs that grow and die, and the nut burger, okay? Can't eat a real hamburger. Got to eat the nut burger. Now, this is on the most basic level, and I'm pointing out a basic pattern, but it goes beyond that. And what Waugh understands is There are other kinds of phoniness than just the phoniness of nature. We get the phoniness all the way through here, and this is one particularly near and dear to my heart, and that is education. This is just a hoot. We're in Whispering Glades. The hostess is showing Dennis around. I'm at the bottom of page 52. Mr. Barlow, you are afraid of death. No, I assure you. It is a natural instinct, Mr. Barlow, to shrink from the unknown. But if you discuss it openly and frankly, you remove morbid reflections. This woman took a psychology course once. And then she admits it. That is one of the things the psychoanalysts have taught us. Bring your dark fears into the light of the common day of the common man, Mr. Barlow. Realize that death is not a private tragedy of your own, but the general lot of man. As Hamlet so beautifully writes, know that death is common, all that live must die. Perhaps you think it morbid and even dangerous to give thought to this subject, Mr. Barlow. The contrary has been proved by scientific investigation. Many people let their vital energy lag prematurely and their earning capacity diminish simply through fear of death. The woman's an idiot. And what we know is, at some point, she took a psychology course at school and has these set phrases she can spout. And at some point, someone told her something about Hamlet and gave her a quote from Hamlet, but she thought he was the author, not the character. It is, heaven help us, a typical American education where the people know nothing. But that's just a little hint of it. We get the real skewering of American education with poor Amy Thanatogenes, who is, if you will, the repository of all that is horrible in this world that Waugh found. I'm on page 90. I've always been artistic, she said. I took art at college as my second subject one semester. I'd taken it as first subject, only Dad lost his money in religion, so I had to learn a trade. I'll come back to that. Dennis says, and what else did you take at college? Just psychology and Chinese. Notice, she went to college and took what? Three subjects, art, psychology, and Chinese. It is a perfect description of the insane American educational system, cafeteria education. You have to take so many courses. Take a little of this and a little of that and a little of that. Now you're educated. Here's your diploma. At the school where I teach, if you are an engineer or a scientist or a mathematician, you have to take two humanities courses. So you will know something about humanities. On a given semester, you could take those two courses and take a course in 19th century Japanese history and a course in the novels of Toni Morrison. You get your degree. Oh yes, I studied the humanities when I went to college. Oh yes, I took courses in the humanities. What does this person know? Nothing. Nothing, okay? What else did you take at college? Just psychology and Chinese. I didn't get on so well with Chinese. But of course, they were secondary subjects too. So the three courses she took were secondary subjects, which means she didn't have to pay a whole lot of attention to them for cultural background. Yes, and what was your main subject? Beauty craft. Now, it's devastating. It's devastating. But a perfect example of the irony of Waugh. What is he saying? There is no education. There is a phony front that appears to be education. There is no education. These poor people are getting degrees and know nothing. Dib of this, a dab of that, little of this, and none of it coheres, and what does it matter anyway? Okay? But what do they think of themselves? Educate. Well, I've been to college. I took art and Chinese and psychology. Everybody takes psychology. What was your principal subject? Beauty craft. Oh, says Dennis, you know, permanence, facials, wax, everything you get in a beauty parlor. Only, of course, we went in for history and theory, too. I wrote my thesis on hairstyling in the Orient. Oh, Let me tell you, with this book, you pause and look at any paragraph and you fall on the floor dying with laughter. Every single sentence in it is not only a gem of style, perfectly written. You couldn't, was acknowledged perhaps the master of style in the English language in this century. Every sentence is perfection. You could not improve it. But every single sentence is an absolute gut bust. It is so funny. But you've got to pause and look at what's going on. It is wicked. It is wicked in its skewering of what he found here, okay? I need to move a little more swiftly. Let's go to the big subject, and here it is. Not only is education completely phony, but so is religion. I'm back at the same place, page 90. Poor Amy talking about her religious upbringing. He lost his money in religion. Yes, the four square gospel. That's why I'm called Amy, after Amy McPherson. Absolutely real. Real woman, and that was indeed the religion she founded. It was called the Four Square Gospel, okay? Dad wanted to change the name after he lost his money. I wanted to change it too, but it rather stuck. Mother always kept forgetting what we changed it to, and then she'd find a new one. Once you start changing a name, you see, there's no reason ever to stop. I'll come back to that. Horrifying vision, okay? She then talks later about her mother on page 93. I'd never seen a dead person before because Dad left Mother before he died, if he is dead, and Mother went east to look for him when I left college and died there. And I had never been inside West Spring Glades, as after we lost our money, Mother took to new thought. It comes from New England, absolutely real, grounded in the writings of Emerson, okay? Again, this is real. He didn't make this up. New thought, and wouldn't have it that there was such a thing as death. A wonderful American religion that denies death, called New Thought, because the old thought indeed said death exists. Okay, this is wacky, but this is what the poor woman has been raised in. Okay, and it's absolutely. Let me put it this way: she has been given nothing. She has been given nothing. No education, no religious training. And what we get, of course, is Dennis, rascal that he is, manages to tap into this. But the real phoniness of religion will come to focus on the happier hunting grounds, okay? Because the debasement of religious thought that is going on at Whispering Glades is mocked and parodied in an outlandish manner in what happens in the happier hunting grounds. I'm postponing that just briefly. I'll come back to it. But again, the point I'm making, religion is hollow. I'll explore that further when we get to the happier hunting grounds. But there is no, religion itself is a facade, a false front, without anything substantial behind it. Now, the saddest thing perhaps, and it is concomitant with all of this, if you deny nature, if you deny religion, if you have no education, if there's no culture to support you, then you cannot possibly have an identity. You cannot know who you are. Every single thing that defines the human being has been removed from these people and something phony and false put in its place. And this comes right from the beginning again. Just as we had the false building fronts in Hollywood, we have from the beginning people who are false. I got to read the whole thing because it's so funny. One of Waugh's great creations, Juanita del Pablo.